I read all the best Bitcoin content out there so that you can listen. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read with Guy Swan. I have been getting, seeing a lot of comments or getting a lot of questions about the differences between proof of work and proof of stake. So we are going to get into a couple of quick reads by Hugo Huynh that really break down all of the trade-offs and the limitations of proof of stake and why it is not an alternative to proof of work. This is the Crypto Economy with Guy Swan. Thank you for joining me, crew. And we are going to get into our read. This will actually be three different pieces because he breaks down a lot of the, like, each of the different scenarios, and it's a really good series, so I think you guys are going to enjoy it. Without further ado, let's go ahead and get into the read, and we will jump into some fun commentary on this piece afterward. This one is, again, by Hugo Huynh, and it is on his Medium page, and it's titled Proof of Stake and the Wrong Engineering Mindset. Proof of stake is all the rage these days. Ethereum Casper, Cardano, Ouroboros, etc., you name it. The rising interest in proof of stake protocols is probably due to the desire to scale blockchains indefinitely, combined with the mistaken notion that proof of work is somehow wasteful. Go here for a detailed discussion on proof of work. A topic not emphasized enough with proof-of-stake protocols is their lack of resilience in dealing with worst-case scenarios. For example, extraordinary events that could knock offline or partition a significant portion of the network, or even the entire network, or the risk of stolen, purchased private keys. One might think that these kinds of scenarios are rare or unlikely, but A, they might not necessarily be as rare as you think, and B, even something with a 0.1% chance of happening means that it will happen in the long run. These are what Nassim Taleb termed black swan events. Simply put, these events are highly unlikely to happen, but when they do happen, the results are often catastrophic. We humans regularly underestimate high-impact, long-tail events. For example, the illusion that tomorrow is safe simply because it has been safe for the last 10 or 100 years. Careful consideration of long-tail events is especially important in the design of a protocol that has the potential to become the backbone of the global economy that millions of people and businesses will rely on. We must handle Bitcoin software with the same respect we handle nuclear reactor software. In engineering literature, this class of software is known as critical systems. There's three types of critical systems: safety critical, mission critical, and business critical. Bitcoin fits the bill for all three. Loss of money can cause loss of life. There is absolutely no margin for error. Experienced engineers wouldn't sleep well at night even with the current level of Bitcoin security, which is far from perfect. They know that we're always one step away from a disaster, no matter how sound things are on paper and how smoothly things seem to have gone so far. There have been many high-profile engineering failures in the past that clearly demonstrate this type of hidden danger. Some examples. 1. Concord crash in 2003. Concord, from 1976 to 2003, was one of the only two supersonic passenger planes ever existed. The Concord crash happened as a result of a blown tire hitting the fuel tank during takeoff, causing a chain reaction. Concord was once considered one of the, quote, safest planes in the world. 2. The Challenger disaster, 1986. NASA initially estimated that the odds of failure was 1 in 100,000. Richard Feynman led the investigation which discovered the cause to be the failure of the O-rings to expand in 32-degree weather. The true odds were closer to 1 in 100, a thousand-fold miscalculation. 3. Fukushima Meltdown, 2011. Japan is one of the best countries in terms of earthquake technology and earthquake safety. The Fukushima meltdown happened as a result of what you can call the perfect storm of disasters, a magnitude 9 earthquake, the most powerful ever recorded in Japan, followed by a 15-meter, or roughly 50 feet, once-in-a-thousand-year tsunami. Thinking about worst-case scenarios is an absolute must when dealing with critical systems, and even more important when these systems are on a global scale. Let's examine how proof of work and proof of stake deal with network partition and unexpected outage. Just to drive home the point that this type of scenario is not as far-fetched as one might think, during the Arab Spring movement, the Turkish government successfully performed BGP hijacking to block Twitter traffic from Turkish citizens. China has even more sophisticated tools to block internet traffic as part of their Great Firewall. You can also imagine situations like wars, where countries might try to take out the enemy's communication infrastructure, which would be typically the first target, since whoever has better communication gains the upper hand. So how resilient is a proof-of-work or proof-of-stake system under these scenarios? Let's go through some examples. Scenario 1. The entire network is forced offline for some period, then reboot. Since all regions might not reboot and regain contact with each other simultaneously, what you'll likely end up with is several regions starting their own independent chain from the last common block just before the network went dark, in effect creating multiple chain splits. When cross-region communication gets reestablished, nodes on these independent chains will come into contact with one another. In proof of work, the nodes will automatically self-organize and eventually gravitate towards one single chain, the chain with the most accumulated proof of work, and the most secure. It will be painful, since some chains will get wiped out in the process, but it will work, and the behavior is deterministic. In proof of stake, the nodes would have no idea which chain is the more correct chain. Unlike proof of work, proof of stake has no objective yardstick to compare the realness between two chains. Behavior is indeterministic and impossible to automate away without introducing some arbitrary rules that increase the attack surface. The split might become permanent, as some proof of stake protocols make it impossible to go back too far into the past. Link provided. Proof-of-stake protocol designers often go to great lengths to, quote, punish misbehaving actors. What they don't consider is the possibility that all nodes act honestly, but there's a chain split nonetheless. Scenario 2. Some portions of the network get partitioned from the main network. It turns out that this scenario results in a similar outcome to what we saw in Scenario 1. Partitions will continue to run as if everything is operational, except that the number of active staking nodes in each isolated partition is smaller. When the partitions regain contact with the main network, confusion will ensue. Nodes have no idea which chain is the canonical chain. One crucial difference between Scenario 1 and Scenario 2 is that the likelihood of Scenario 2 happening is even higher. Redirecting traffic is easier than shutting down traffic wholesale. We already saw it being done. Partitions can be as small as a small town's network. We can imagine something like that happening once every few years, or even more frequently. Scenario 3. Proof of stake also fares worse in other worst-case scenarios, such as stolen private keys. Wealth distributions often follow power laws, and there's no reason to think cryptocurrencies are any exception. The 1% of crypto, which could just be a handful of people, might very well control a significant portion or the majority of the total coin supply. these richest proof-of-stake holders' private keys might get stolen as a result of sophisticated social engineering attacks, kidnapping, torture, extortion, etc. By stealing keys instead of renting or buying coins on the open market, the attacker avoids raising the currency value during the attack. Strangely, when considering this attack vector, proof-of-stake protocol designers often assume that buying coins on the open market is the only way to get majority control, and thereby incorrectly conclude that the cost of attacking a proof-of-stake currency is merely determined by its market value. Stealing private keys sidesteps that defense altogether and significantly reduces the cost of attack. A variant of this attack is to purchase old keys from past large stakeholders who no longer have an interest in the currency. In proof of work, this is equivalent to gaining control over the majority hash rate. What can someone with majority hash rate do in proof of work? He can try to double spend or rewrite history, but to double spend, he has to spend a lot of money. Gaining majority control is only the first step. As bad as it sounds, even under this scenario, the protocol still functions as expected, and only one chain can be considered valid, although SPV nodes might get confused, hence the reason running full nodes is often encouraged. To rewrite history costs an even more insane amount of money, so the risk of losing user balance is low. Users could choose to wait out the storm or take action to change the proof-of-work algorithm. All in all, it's a pretty ugly situation, but we can see that gaining majority hash rate in proof-of-work doesn't grant the attacker unlimited power. You have to gain majority control and spend money to carry out an attack. We can think of this as a two-layer defense. When there's an attack, the behavior is deterministic and there's no confusion about which chain is valid. This resilience in hostile situations is underappreciated. In contrast, gaining majority stake in proof of stake grants you unlimited power. You can double spend without spending any extra money, unlike in proof of work. You can also either A, rewrite history, if the protocol doesn't have checkpoints, or B, cause irreconcilable chain splits if the protocol has checkpoints, for example, Casper. Changing proof-of-stake algorithm doesn't help as there's virtually no switching cost, unlike investment in hardware. To sum it up, what proof-of-work gives you are two benefits when it comes to security guarantees. One, proof-of-work protects the future. When there's a chain split, it gives us an objective mechanism, an automatable way of resolving conflicts without requiring manual human intervention or trusted third parties. And two, proof of work protects the past. Getting control of majority hash rate still costs an attacker an enormous amount of time and money to rewrite history, so the balances are somewhat safe. Proof of stake offers neither of these things. Proof of stake proponents might claim that checkpoints alleviate problem number two, but in reality, checkpoints just shift the problem from one area to another. Checkpoints is just a centralized solution that opens up another can of worms. In conclusion, it's very important to have the right mindset when it comes to Bitcoin and blockchain protocol development. They are critical systems that deserve the highest level of engineering. Proof-of-stake protocols are built on faulty and naive assumptions that rapidly break down under worst-case scenarios. Proof-of-stake is a step in the wrong direction, lowering the bar of quality instead of raising it. Part 2. Proof-of-stake, private keys attacks, and unforgeable costliness, the unsung hero. And that concludes Proof of Stake and the Wrong Engineering Mindset, part one of this series. Let's go ahead and hit our sponsor, and then I want to talk a little bit and expand on these ideas that Hugo brings up in this piece. All right, and again, that was Hugo Huynh and Proof of Stake, the Wrong Engineering Mindset. And one of the big, well, first off, we've read a couple of other articles by him on the show, and he has some really great stuff. He has a couple of really awesome pieces about proof of work. I think it was a series that we read. I will link to that in the show notes just so that you guys can listen to it if you haven't yet. But we've talked about the design philosophy and like the engineering mindset on this show numerous times. My favorite piece on this is Budion's the Bitcoin and software reliability. It's a really great basically like Hugo's like little introduction here, just talking about like this needs to be planning for the worst case scenarios. And this is safety critical, mission critical, and business critical. Is that like this is how this should be treated? It should be handled like nuclear reactor software. Well, it's basically that in an entire article. I'm hitting it from a couple of different angles, and that's absolutely a crucial perspective with this. And the idea that like, the problems here is that this thing must survive on its own because consensus. The mechanism for consensus is everything here. That's really the invention that has occurred, is the means of having an objective, non-political, non-social means of coming to consensus, of everyone being on the same page, regardless of any scenario, of most specifically the worst case scenarios, because we're talking about something that we need to exist, need to survive for decades and decades, hopefully 100 years or more, as long as it possibly can. And because it is such a mission critical thing, it's like building in a backdoor or some sort of fundamental like critical fault in the foundation of the internet. Like if the internet went down, there would be an absolute catastrophe. It would be a nightmare to like of all the business that got shut down, of the goods that couldn't get to and from where they're trying to go. I mean, it would be horrific. And this is we're talking about making this more important. We're talking about a protocol that is going to house our money, our livelihoods, our basically everything, the value that we create and exchange in the economy. It's what enables exchange. It has to be treated with the utmost care. It cannot be, move fast and break things is the absolute, could not be further from where you should be with a mindset when building this sort of a system. And that's where so many things go wrong. But I love that he brought up the Nassim Taleb, like the Black Swan events, and that we kind of think it's like, oh, well, these are really unlikely, so we don't have to worry about them or think about them. And like, that's the exact opposite of the truth, because all of these events, if something is possible, it essentially is going to happen. It is just a matter of probability. I have on the Bitcoin Survivors book list one of my favorite since I read it, and I'm probably going to go back soon and listen to it again just because it was so much fun, is The Drunkard's Walk, how our lives are ruled by randomness. And it's about so many misconceptions and why people fail to foresee. It's very, very similar in at least conceptually, Nassim Taleb's Black Swan, and the idea of not being prepared or not being able to see those massive shifting events that are absolutely possible, that are scenarios that will play out, and it is just a matter of probability of when two, three, or four different things line up. And that's why when it's not even hard to imagine. That's one of those things. These aren't even really super rare scenarios or expectations, you could say. Like, I think it's pretty obvious that Bitcoin or these cryptocurrency systems are going to run afoul of a powerful government. I mean, it's challenging the monetary position, the economic position of some of the most powerful economic actors in the world. I mean, some of them, just the most powerful economic actors in the world, the people who own, who literally have printing control over the world reserve currency, are being threatened by this. This is actually chipping away. No matter how small it is an alternative to that system, one that ignores their capital controls, that ignores their monetary policy, that ignores their means of manipulating the economy into the behaviors they claim are subjectively more important or more desirable. And that authority is not going to just be like, oh, shrugs, guys, I guess we just got to pack this up. So if we're not planning for this thing to survive against its literal competition, its market competition, regardless of the fact that that market is, well, more importantly, the fact that that market is violent and political, then we're not designing anything that's ever going to last. Or at least it's not going to be significant because it will not be allowed to be significant if it can't survive. And obviously gives, I like his examples of the supposed rare or impossible occurrences that they're just going to happen at some point. So let's dig into the whole differences between proof of work and proof of stake. And there's a lot more to cover on this topic, but I just want to stick strictly to this article because I really love, he has a really good part two, and then he has a follow-up, which isn't really part three, but it's a follow-up article that really talks about or specifically hits the time scenario, the idea that proof of work secures cumulatively, whereas proof of stake is not. Well, you know, not going to get into it. Not going to go that far. We will hit that in just a bit. On Friday, probably. In the first scenario is that the entire network is forced offline for some period and you get some sort of a partition. And really the underlying problem in scenario one and scenario two, that some portion of the network is partitioned, is really the same problem, is that proof of stake has no objective way. If there is a persistent split of any size, whether it be a large size or a small, whether it's, you know, one city is partitioned like Hong Kong, or if it's one country like Venezuela or China, if it is segmented off after you get past that, and they try to reconsolidate, there's simply no way to know what is correct and what is not. And this is even worse because they design, their attempts to solve this are to design punishments into the system. And there was actually in Vitalik's Proof of Stake Design Philosophy, written numerous years ago, and I did read this on the show, and then I also read Tur de Meester's response, the rebuttal to the Proof of Stake Design Philosophy, which I don't know, they're way, way early on. I guess they're probably in the episodes in the 40s or the 50s or something like that. Definitely a good one to listen to. If you do, forgive me. My intro was really crappy. My sound quality was awful. So don't judge me too much if you go back and listen to it. But one of the problems with trying to come to terms with which chain is correct after that is that these stakers are going to, any staker that followed one chain versus the other has very strong incentives to persist that break, to continue to break consensus and have two separate chains, two separate currencies. And it's specifically because they may have done a ton of business already on this partition chain, and they have no reason to want to consolidate, and they have a mechanism by which they can refuse to consolidate, essentially. And when the whole thing has to resort to essentially social consensus, in order to pick which one is which, well, then you don't have an innovation. You've got nothing new. Social consensus is that thing that sucks miserably that we are trying to get around. Like, if you think, and what's funny is Vitalik actually argues this in a proof of stake design philosophy. So I'm not strawmanning here. He thinks that a social consensus is easy, that it's really good. And I think if you just, all you have to do is go to Twitter and ask, like, you know, does everybody agree on what is a crime and what is not, what is right and what is wrong? Is that easy? Is Twitter full of people just agreeing about on these issues, and particularly on what our problems are to begin with, and more importantly, what those solutions are, even if we can identify the correct problem and identify a common problem, that we have any sort of consensus on what the hell we're going to do about it? I mean, I think Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin Gold, Bitcoin Satoshi's vision, all of this is proof that social consensus is garbage. Social consensus sucks. It is only within, and that's the whole point, is to have an objective consensus, one that you don't have to get into messy, inefficient, hateful politics to figure out for the network, to figure out what the hell consensus is, to figure out what the hell right and wrong is. It's inherent and objective, and there's no questioning it. And the network can easily and naturally return to its previous state if there's a partition in proof of work. But in proof of stake, you don't have that. And the problem is made even worse. First, the problem is made worse by the punishment if you have any sort of a persistent split. And then it's made worse still by checkpoints, because checkpoints become a centralized way. It's not as if your competing chain doesn't have checkpoints and then the correct chain does. No, you have checkpoints from party A on the first chain, and you have checkpoints from party B on the alternate chain, and you have no idea which one to trust. You have the exact same problems. Checkpoints just move the problem from figuring out which chain to trust to figure out which checkpoint to trust, and you end up inherently centralizing because that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to trust the centralized party, the trusted third party's checkpoint, versus the unknown party's checkpoint, or the supposed malicious actor based on the social consensus that we've determined is the malicious party here. But obviously, it's just going to be the Ethereum Foundation or Infura's checkpoint or the main developer's checkpoint or whatever it is, however the checkpoint is being determined, of the centralized party, which just means that what the state of the chain is whichever one they sign. It's got nothing to do with proof of stake. Proof of stake just becomes totally arbitrary, and it's like, why even, you're just putting a Rube Goldberg machine on something you've already made a decision about. So, this is even worse because, and this is something that Turtomeister brought up, I think this was in the rebuttal to it. There's no way he didn't bring it up, about the mini blockchains attack, is that there is no proof of work has an explicit and incredibly high cost. So, and there's no way around it. Proof of stake has no cost to creating the chain. It has a supposed socially determined punishment for violating consensus, but that is totally arbitrary. That's based on whose consensus we are following. That's based on which chain it's on the assumption that we know in some terrible scenario which chain we're supposed to be concerned about, which the terrible scenario is the thing that this technology is actually there, proof of work, brilliantly solves. But with proof of stake, because there is no enormous cost, there's no real world cost to creating a chain, is that not only do you have to deal with a single person's like malicious chain, if supposedly we can determine which one is malicious, but they can also continually make chains. They can just keep doing this over and over again. They don't have to broadcast one competing chain to confuse people. They can broadcast 100 competing chains, and even worse, they can broadcast, they can edit as deep in the ledger as they want, which is a little bit getting ahead of another thing that we're going to read, so I'll actually just stop there. But that's one of the other things about the difference between proof of work and proof of stake, is because proof of work is a cumulative real cost, it has incredibly, like, vastly different dynamics over the long term, whereas proof of stake never really changes. It is proof of, it's stake right this second, and that's basically it. But all of this, it's so funny that all of this is about ensuring one of the key solutions to this. And it's so funny how often everything comes back to this same argument, and how many different ways this applies, is that this is all dependent on whether or not your network gets partitioned. So not only does proof of work have an inherent objective way to come to consensus if there is a partition, but the very design philosophy is recognizing, with Bitcoin specifically, is recognizing how much of a disaster it is and how 100% against, like, it just removes the need or the purpose of the protocol itself if we are not using the protocol mechanism as our consensus, if we're not depending on that specifically in the worst case scenarios, then we don't have an innovation, because where it matters, we still have the old, same, flawed, inefficient system to fall back on. And it's about block size. That the ability to get the information across these barriers, that if Venezuela turns off their internet, if China tries to choke data coming in and out of Hong Kong, that that all of this, again, Bitcoin is the blockade runner. And that's another episode. It's a read I did from Carr Campit, the host, one of the hosts of the Friends Against Government podcast, which if you've been listening to the show, you've heard him multiple times. And I'm actually going to have him on again in just a little bit. But a great little article about Bitcoin being the blockade runner of the digital age, that it can sneak through every crack. It can get across every wall. It can, you know, burrow under every barrier and, fly through space if it needs to get to its destination. Is that not only does, proof of work itself provide that huge benefit, but the design and conservative, the care that is given to Bitcoin, understanding that it is such a mission critical thing, and that consensus is the one mechanism that is that's so powerful in this, that there must not be any scenario, or at least as few scenarios as possible. Obviously, there's no such thing as assurances here. It's just degrees. That partitions won't happen, even in the face of the worst case scenario of the large and incredibly powerful adversaries. And proof of stake is actually used as an excuse to pack as much data into this thing as possible, to make it vulnerable in another way. So proof of stake is vulnerable to these two additional scenarios, and does not have the objective way to find consensus again and recover from one of these attacks. And it's constantly resorting to or explicitly choosing to have the messy political social consensus. So not only is all that happening, but it's also attempting to use proof of stake constantly as an excuse to quote unquote scale the thing, so that people don't have to keep far back in the history, so that people can just, you know, keep 100 blocks and that's good enough. And in the worst case scenario, it's like, it's not going to happen. Don't worry about it. But that increases the risk that any of these scenarios, so they're saying, okay, these scenarios are rare, but then they're using the excuse to create a situation or to change the protocol or the underlying protocol in such a way that the scenarios are going to be more frequent, that they're going to be far more likely. So they're using the excuse that they're rare to make them not rare. And that is so backwards. I guess we'll stop there. I don't need to go any further. I've already ranted for 18 minutes here. And we've got part two coming tomorrow, another one by Hugo Nguyen, and of course the follow-up that he wrote sometime later. By the way, this was written in March of 2018, so this is a pretty old article, but I just thought it was really relevant, and I like this whole series. Huge fan of Hugo and his work. I will link to his previous articles that that we've read on the show, and to his Medium page. There is a lot of great pieces to dive into. And I'll link to his Twitter as well, so don't forget to check him out up there. Follow him and drop some applause on this article. So thank you guys so much for listening. This is The Crypto Economy. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. I am bringing you the best in the Bitcoin written content, in the ocean of amazing stuff written and explored and discussed online in audio to your ears, so that even all the people who do not have the time to devote to this like I do can maybe still learn and hear all these amazing ideas. So thank you so much for listening. And if you would like to support this show, I have got myself a Patreon account at patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy, and any amount that you can donate to help out this show would be wonderful. It really, really goes a long way. And also, it just means a lot. And it gets you access to the Crypto Economy Crew Telegram, where I'm hanging out and I got a big crew of guys that are just always in there talking about Bitcoin or some crazy stuff. And we have a lot of fun and we'd love to have you in there. As little as $1 a month will get you there. And, you know, come hang out. Come join the Crypto Economy crew. You can find that again at patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy. And you'll know that you're helping to bring all of the best Bitcoin content in cyberspace to the audio versions they deserve. You're making the world a better place.
Shit. Yeah, if you can't do that, if you don't want to do the Patreon thing, just share the show out. That is one thing that you can always do is send it out to somebody else in the Bitcoin space, somebody who's interested in learning about these things and wants to know the principles and the fundamentals behind these technologies and the mindset, the engineering mindset and the philosophy that led us here. That is what we do here. That is what I do here at the Crypto Economy. I am Guy Swan. I love you all. Thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you next time. Until then, take it easy, guys.